On today's episode of the DFA podcast, we talk about Justin Verlander, Justin Upton, and all the other deals that were made just in time for the waiver wire deadline. It's the DFA podcast, and you won't be claiming us off waivers anytime soon.
Welcome to episode 27 of the DFA podcast, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus. I am one of your two hosts today, Brian Grosnick of Baseball Prospectus, and joining me, thankfully, as always, RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, what's up, man?
Not much other than a busy second trade deadline.
I know. I was a little bit bummed out slash excited that we got a second trade deadline with big moves being made. We had to kind of put something together so that we could record today and talk about the good stuff. And of course, that means ditching Sean again for another episode, which I feel a little bad about, but I'm sure he could probably use the break.
I mean, it's possible he's going to pop up on like Jesus and Miro, and we're just going to be like, wow, he got traded there, huh? So you never know.
Yeah, that would definitely be an upgrade for him. He was he's on a good trajectory if that's the case. So, I don't know. I guess on this podcast, would you be Desus or Miro? I'm not sure.
I'm pretty sure I'm always Desus.
All right. So we'll get into the good stuff. We've got a show today that's going to be a little bit shorter and very tactical. We're going to tackle all those important moves that were made at the post-waiver trade deadline, the guys who are getting ready to load up in some teams for the playoff push. And the big move for today is the Tigers kind of selling off and changing the face of their franchise. They made two big moves, two important moves. They dealt Justin Upton to the Angels for Grayson Long, and they dealt Justin Verlander to the Astros for Daz Cameron, Jake Rogers, and the headliner is probably pitching prospect Franklin Perez. So, I don't know. You want to take it from the Tigers' perspective first because they made both these deals?
Yeah, well, you know, the Tigers also sold a little bit at the deadline. It's clear they're moving to a different phase in the organization's timeline. You know, they're trying to rebuild a little bit, at least retool. And they've shed some salary here. They've shed some long-term commitments. You know, they still have Miguel Cabrera. They still have Victor Martinez and a few other costly deals. But, you know, it seems like they're trying to get younger. They're trying to reset their clock. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, they really had a nice run. I know the last couple of years they haven't been as successful as they would like to have been. But it makes sense that at some point they were going to have to hit reset. And, you know, it seems like they got a pretty good return actually on Verlander. And Upton, you know, it's really possibly a month of Upton. So you add in how corner bats really weren't valued at the deadline. And I guess that deal even makes some sense. But, yeah, I think this is just the beginning of a typical rebuild for them. I'm a little surprised Kinsler is still there and they didn't try to make a move with him at the deadline. But, oh, well, what about you? What do you think of?
Well, I definitely think there's a possibility that they tried to move Kinsler and failed, which wouldn't surprise me too much. I mean, there are a couple of teams that could use Kinsler, but like, for example, I don't know, the Angels, who made a trade for a different expensive second baseman. But yeah, I'm kind of with you. I'm a little surprised by the moves because I didn't see this coming so quickly. I thought it might come in the offseason, this change in tack that the Tigers took. But I do think everything you said is accurate. They're trying to get younger. They're trying to get a little bit better for the long term. You know, one of the things that I'm going to be really interested to see going forward is what their payroll situation looks at like with Mike Ilitch having passed away and him no longer being that kind of driving financial force behind the team, really pushing to win a World Series in his later years. I wonder if we're going to start seeing a team that acts more like a mid-market to smaller market team in Detroit, and maybe that'll affect some of their moves going forward. Maybe this money isn't going to immediately go out and be reinvested in big-time free agents or something like that going forward.
That would make sense. But, Just to remind people, they have like 88 million tied into like five players next season already. Like Miguel Cabrera is going to make 30 million. Jordan Zimmermann is making 24 million. Victor Martinez is making 18 million. You add in some of the buyouts and team options, and yeah, they're still going to be flirting with 100 million, even if they filled like, the bare minimum across the rest of the roster. But that's a good point. They're probably not going to be as, I would guess, aggressive in free agency going forward. But then again, who knows? Maybe there's not going to be that big of a change of philosophy once they get back to the point where it makes sense to be big players of free agency and it makes sense to hand out some of these big contracts to retain their best players. For now, though, I would agree that they're probably going to drop in the payroll rankings.
Yeah, and when you look at Upton specifically, I feel like this is a market where the Tigers can go out in free agency and they can get 60 to 70% of Upton's production at probably 60 to 70% of the price that they would have been paying for him if he was not going to opt out. They could very easily go out and pick up a Jay Bruce type outfielder who would give them a chunk of that production, but more inexpensively. Now, I don't know if they will go out and do that. They've got a couple of interesting guys in house, which they may want to run with, like Steven Moya in the outfield. But yeah, it just seems kind of interesting to see this move. The Tigers probably now don't look like they'll be competitive for a couple of years. I'm not sure if this is a full-scale, like Astros Cubs type of teardown that they're going to be doing. Unfortunately, they don't seem to have the prospect capital, even after these moves, to really start a quick rebuild process. It looks like this might be something that's going to take a couple of years to really kind of see fruition, maybe 4 or 5 years down the line even.
Yeah, I mean, you never know anyway. There's no guarantee that, a full-scale rebuild is actually going to work the first time. So it could be a while until we see Detroit in the postseason picture again. But then again, weird things happen. Maybe they hit big on some of these prospects, and maybe we're talking about them in 2 to 3 years. You never know.
Yeah, that's very true. And one of the things I kind of liken this team to is, it kind of ironically, because that's the team that Upton was traded to, is the Tigers to me now look a lot like the Angels did maybe a year or two ago, with one exception. They don't have Mike Trout. And so I feel like around that, they have a not very good farm system. They have one or two really high quality players. They have one really big financial suck at first base. I really don't want to compare Miguel Cabrera to Albert Pujols too much just yet, because I still think there's a possibility he'll rebound and be a better than average hitter going forward. But I mean, there's a lot of money tied up in some big contracts. There's not a whole lot of help on the farm. And as we see now with Upton going to the Angels and the way that they're playing, they were able to turn it around relatively quickly. The problem, and what will always be a problem for any team other than the Angels, is that the Tigers don't have a Mike Trout type player. They don't have anything close to a Mike Trout type player. Their best player right now is probably Michael Fulmer. And so, they would, if they hit it big on a talent that can provide, five, six, seven wins, a mini Trout, then I could see things turning around very quickly. Without that, they're just kind of it like any other team in this rebuilding cycle, I think.
Yeah, and I was going to make a joke about how they don't have a Mike Trout, they have the guy who beat Mike Trout in the MVP voting a few times. But never mind, not going to get into that can of worms. I think we should transition here to the Angels because I've been really impressed with what Billy Epler has done as general manager, not just in terms of finding relievers who really didn't look like they'd be big contributors and slotting them in and having them perform well, but also the smaller moves he's made. And you go back to the offseason when he was acquiring guys like Danny Espinosa and Cameron Maben and Luis Valbuena. And I know that collectively those guys really didn't work out. Espinosa was awful. Maben was bleh. Valbuena hasn't really been as good as he had been in recent seasons, but it all fit a common vision where he was trying to find, cheapish one win, two win players, plug them in around Trout and hope that Trout's star power and even Andrelton Simmons to some extent were enough to, guide them to at least a 500 mark and maybe a little bit more. And I see these two trades yesterday as a continuation of that vision where he went out and he got not only Justin Upton, but Brandon Phillips. He didn't pay a lot in either case. I mean, You got Phillips for Tony Sanchez, who has not been relevant in what, five seasons?
Yeah, that's about right.
And yeah, and you plug both of these guys in, and suddenly this team looks like it could be a realistic wild card contender. I still have a lot of reservations about the pitching staff, at least the rotation. But they, they've got Andrew Heaney back, and who knows, maybe there's enough there to, sneak into the postseason. If not, it's still a good effort. It was still a good vision here, and it really didn't cost them a lot long term. Of course, they don't really have that many prospects to cost them, but
Right.
if you're looking at how you can build a winner without a farm system to draw from, this is pretty good blueprint. Though, as you mentioned, having Mike Trout and even having Simmons this season, those are two of what, the top five or six performers in the American League. So that helps. But no, I think Epler has done a pretty solid job. And if I had to vote for Executive of the Year, I would consider giving him one of them.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. I agree that the process this offseason and before has been very good, even though the results in some of the cases of these, smaller transactions that you mentioned haven't been so great. You could throw Ben Revere's name in there too, the guy who's probably going to get bumped for Justin Upton. Again, low cost, attempting to shore up the weaknesses, like the big gaping holes that this team had in its roster, just didn't quite work out because Revere fell apart. So yeah, you've got a lot of really smart, savvy decisions that maybe not have worked out so well, but being able to get Justin Upton for a song, or in this case, a long, not a bad deal.
Oh my God.
Yeah, thanks. I that was, since Sean's not here, I've got to jump in with, some really terrible jokes, but I just feel like there's one big risk to acquiring Justin Upton, and that's that if in the next month he tears his ACL or has some other sort of really horrible, debilitating injury that's going to affect his performance, then he's not going to opt out of his contract. And you're on the hook for another one of these enormous contracts, like the Pujols type contract. We're talking $22 million every year. But if not, it's got to be a given that he's opting out because I don't think the Tigers trade him for this kind of return if he's not opting out. Would you agree with that?
I think he's absolutely going to opt out. If you look at his contract, he has potentially 4 years left. Each year is 22 million plus some change. Of course, when I say change, I mean like 125,000.
Yeah, I wish I had
So
that kind of change.
yeah, I mean, I wish I had just like one payment of that change. But he's just barely 30 years old. He literally turned 30 a week ago. And he's having basically either the best or the second best season of his career. And yeah, I just think he's absolutely going to opt out. I think even if he doesn't necessarily get a ton more than 22 million annually, I think he can probably find a 5-year deal. So he'd effectively, get one more year around 22 million. And I think that'd probably be enough of a temptation for him to opt out. He's been really good this year.
He
And I
really
feel like
has.
he's, yeah, I feel like he's not getting any attention whatsoever. Like, this is a guy who, back when he was traded from the Diamondbacks to the Braves, everybody was like, oh, he's got so much potential and he's got the potential to be an MVP candidate consistently. And he's never really done that. Like, he has not finished higher than 17th in MVP balloting since that trade, which was much maligned at the time. And now nobody even talks about it. It's like, eh, whatever, But yeah, this is basically the fully actualized version of Justin Upton. He's going to finish with more than 30 home runs. He's got a chance to finish around 12 to 13 stolen bases. And, he's a good player. He's a very good player, even if you look at his WAR. I mean, guess his Baseball Reference WAR score right now.
Well, I have filed a transaction analysis on him, so I was looking into that, but I will guess that it's probably, what, 4.7?
Is 5.0.
Okay, yeah.
It's a
So
good player.
he is a very, very good player, and there is a little bit of noise, I think, with him this year in terms of the WAR metrics because at least Baseball Prospectus's fielding runs above average has him as a very good defensive player this year, which is probably not what he is. He's a fine defensive outfielder, but everything in his past has shown average to below average. So I think there's a little bit of noise there. But like you said, he's an on-base machine. He provides power consistently. He never plays in less than 150 games, really. Doesn't seem to get injured. I mean, what wouldn't you want from a consistency standpoint, he does tend to run these kind of hot streaks where he has, big highs and low lows. We saw a lot of that last year where the lows outstripped the highs. But when you factor it out over the course of his career to this point, he's a relatively consistent 3 to 4 to 5 win player who relatively consistently provides production that's like 25 to 40% better than league average. I mean, that's a legitimate star.
Yeah. And, like you said, they gave up Grayson Long, who seems like he could be maybe a back of the rotation starter in about a year's time. But you got to make that deal every day if you're the Angels. That just, like you're built to win while Mike Trout is there. Like, let's not worry about if you could have a never back end starter in a year's time. Go out there and do the best you can to win now while you're getting, these ridiculous performances from Mike Trout every single season. And I think the other benefit to getting a guy like Upton, who has name value, who has, proven middle of the order tendencies, is that it could get Mike Socha to knock Albert Pujols down the lineup. And that might just be as simple as getting Albert Pujols to sign off on it. So I don't know if that's definitely going to happen. Maybe they're just going to slot in Upton behind Pujols or whatever. But if they could potentially knock Pujols down the lineup with Upton, then you have to like this trade even more because, it would probably help them a little bit if Pujols did go further down the lineup. So.
Well, I mean, it's been pretty well documented that Pujols has been one of the worst players in baseball this year because, his offense has fallen down so much and he can barely move around at this point. Just like you said, I don't think Pujols would have been really excited about moving down in the lineup for a younger player, but Upton is a, four-time All-Star, proven commodity. That's a lot different. Even if we can talk for a minute about Brandon Phillips, if Phillips is going to take a spot at the top of the order, which he shouldn't, but if he does, I think Pujols would be more open to moving down because these are guys with proven track records. They're excellent clubhouse guys from all indications. I mean, everybody loves Brandon Phillips pretty much, unless you're in the media. I mean, there's
Yes.
a lot of good reasoning for more traditional baseball guys like Pujols and Socha to be more comfortable with making some changes, I think, at this point. So let's talk for just a minute about Phillips. He's replacing Caleb Cowart probably as the regular second baseman for the Angels, I would imagine. That's probably an upgrade, even though Phillips isn't the same player he used to be, right?
Yeah, and I actually did a podcast with Brandon Warren a few days ago that was lost to the sands of technology. And I actually talked about Phillips and I said, you know what? I think in 10 to 15 years, when some of Phillips' inflammatory comments and acts off the field are forgotten or smoothed over, that we're going to look back at, especially the end of his career, and say, you know what? He was probably a lot better than we gave him credit for being. And the reason I mentioned that is because, second basemen don't tend to age well. And yet, Phillips, since turning 30 years old, his OPS pluses are 118, 99, 94, 90, 97, 95, and he's working on a 96 mark this year. That is remarkably consistent. And I know it's not great, but that's really pretty solid. And if you evaluate his defense on the sweet side, and defensive metrics have been up and down on him in recent years, but I think you can say he's probably a 1 to 1.5 win player, maybe even closer to 2 if you're still sweet on the glove. And for him to consistently turn that in since turning 30, I mean, that's pretty impressive to me. And yeah, Caleb Cowart had played really well this season, or had. I think his numbers have tailed off a bit lately, but I think Phillips is an upgrade, and I think it makes all the sense in the world to slot him into that lineup. And again, on paper, it's starting to look like a legitimate postseason threat. Whereas, before it was sort of smoke and mirrors, and to some extent, that's still true of the rotation. But yeah, I think Eppler has done a pretty good job, and these two moves yesterday were just, I have no complaints. I don't see how anyone can be against either of these moves.
Yeah, just to clarify on Cowart a little bit, his performance has tailed off quite a bit, and so he has not hit very well at all recently. But still, he probably improves their bench because as a guy who now they have a guy who was starting who can back up at third, back up at second base. I mean, that's pretty useful to them. One quick thing about Phillips that I think is really interesting for this team is, as you mentioned, he's really maintained his performance as he's gotten older. But one of the things that's most interesting to me about that is that his hit tool really hasn't diminished very much at all. He's hitting like 290 for the season already, which is what he did last year. And as much as we want to talk about batting averages not being a particularly good stat to talk about how good a player is, I do think when you get into the playoffs and the playoff chase, it may be beneficial to this Angels team to have another player who is getting in play by hits rather than necessarily walking or providing a lot of power. He does provide some power, but I do think teams really like having the guy with a better hit tool and the more likelihood to put a ball in play, especially when we get into September and especially October. So I think that might give Socia another kind of weapon that they can use in terms of a situational hitting aspect a little bit.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And I would just say, I feel like we've gone so far against batting average that we're blind to the fact that it does have value. You're going to get most of your on-base percentage from your batting average. You're going to get a lot of your slugging percentage from your batting average. Is it overvalued? Perhaps. Is it a great one-stop metric? No. But it does matter. You can't just, it's very hard to hit 230 or 190 and be a productive big league player. And even if you can pull that off, it's such a special skill set that it's ridiculous to pretend that anyone can do it or that anyone and everyone can replicate that year in and year out. I don't know. I think we went too far with the batting average stuff. And Phillips is a good example of that because, as you said, he's not necessarily going to walk a ton. He's not necessarily going to hit for a ton of power, but he's consistently up there in the 290s. I mean, you mentioned he's hitting 290, 291 this year. That's three consecutive seasons he's going to finish between 290 and 295 if he's able to pull that off. That's impressive. And that's where he gets a lot of his offensive value. And I don't really think there's anything wrong with that,
No,
So.
it's a matter of expectations and managing those expectations. I think the problem with Phillips and his batting average versus his on-base percentage when he was playing in Cincinnati had a lot to do with the fact that they would put him in batting order positions where he was not maybe the best sabermetric choice to hit there, where whether it was hitting at the top of the lineup in front of Joey Votto, where Votto couldn't drive him in because he was out all the time, or relying on him to be the run producer, which I think probably at some stages in his career in Cincinnati was the better position for him, because of his power and because of his ability to make contact. But yeah, I definitely agree with you. I think that while batting average is a bad stat to determine how good a player is, it's a great stat to determine one particular skill for a player. And that's super, super valuable.
Yeah, and I just think there's still value in knowing the complexion of a player's offensive production as opposed to just the overall value of it. On that
Preach
note, though,
into the choir, man.
so we should probably talk about the other big American League West trade from the buyer's perspective.
Oh,
And
man.
what I'm talking about, of course, is the Justin Verlander trade. He went to the Astros at literally the last minute before the deadline for Franklin Perez, Daz Cameron, and Jake Rogers. Grosnick, are the Astros now the favorite in the American League for you?
I mean, they were before. This doesn't change anything for me. This
Oh, see, I had
really makes no
Cleveland.
difference.
See, I had Cleveland as the favorite. I don't know, call it a gut feel, but I thought Cleveland was the team to beat still, even though the Astros obviously have the best record in the American League.
Well, I think it's close. I don't think it's cut and dry that the Astros are head and shoulders above everybody. I think it is cut and dry that the Astros and the Indians are head and shoulders above the rest of the teams in the American League. But I do think that the thing about this Verlander acquisition is the Astros gave up a lot of talent, specifically in Perez, but a little bit in Daz Cameron, who I still like, in order to get a guy who is much more about the narrative and the star power and the potential of, hey, isn't it cool that we have a Hall of Fame caliber player on this team, and at any moment, especially in big moments, he could come through and look like a Hall of Famer again. Because in terms of his raw performance, especially this year, looking a little bit at last year, Justin Verlander may not be one of the top four starters in this Astros rotation. You're adding a back-end starter and you're paying a high premium for it in the hopes that, one, he will be durable, two, he will occasionally be able to flash some of the old Justin Verlander. And honestly, I think three is this is a superstar PR move in some ways. You're bringing in a incredibly popular, incredibly visible Hall of Fame caliber player to a team that didn't do anything of note at the trade deadline, the first trade deadline, and got kind of creamed for it. that's coming off an enormous citywide natural disaster. I mean, like the stars kind of align to make this a really interesting, crazy kind of move from a narrative perspective. And I think that almost kind of overwhelms the fact that he's probably their fourth starter if you get into the playoffs.
Yeah, and I would just note that he's reportedly already dealing with fatigue in his shoulder. And there was some talk about whether he would even make his next start. Does seem like that's likely at this point, but that speaks to your point about hoping that he remains durable. I will say that I saw an interesting, and it was selective endpoints, but I saw an interesting statistic out there that if you go back to, I think it's like the last start in May through his most recent start, which obviously was a few days ago, he's sporting something like a low 3 ERA with, 80 more strikeouts than walks and 100 and something innings. So,
Wow, that's good.
yeah, so I think he's actually, pitched better than his overall statistics suggest. But your point about him possibly not being one of their two or three best starters is well taken. That said, I do like the move from Houston's perspective, even though they gave up talent. The clubhouse was kind of revolting a little bit, it seemed. The fact that they didn't do anything. I don't know if this is a direct answer to that because I feel like if you were trying to make everyone happy, you would have done it earlier in the month. But I do like the acquisition because I have a lot of reservations about that rotation. Once you get, that many injury-prone guys together, I always get a little timid. And this was true of the Dodgers too, and a reason that I argued they should go and get Darvish because you never know. I mean, McCullers has battled injury issues and obviously, Charlie Morton has a history of injury issues, and we can keep going down the list here. And basically, everyone in that rotation is either hurt or has been hurt, Dallas Keuchel included. So I don't think it hurts to go out there and get a Verlander who, granted, is dealing with his own issues, but historically, he's been pretty durable. And at minimum, it gives you a greater probability that two or three of these good starters will be healthy come postseason time. And that's really what this team's looking forward to. Like, there's no division race for them to worry about. There's really, I guess you can say there's sort of a home field advantage race at this point, with what they have like 4 wins over everyone else. So even then, you're kind of reaching a little bit, barring a sudden collapse. Even then, like, does home field advantage really make that big of a difference? Probably not. They're going to be playing with DH no matter what. And yeah, I don't know. I just like this move, even though it does have its own risks to it.
Well, I hope I didn't come across as saying I didn't like the move. I do think that this is a good move for Houston. And Houston, one of the digs on Houston up to this point is, well, are they going to spend money like a top-tier contender, like they always kind of promised as a big market team once they were done with their rebuild? And I think this does. I mean, the Tigers paid down a little bit of Verlander's salary, something like 16, 17 million, but they still are on the hook for most of it. I will say this. You made a good point about his recent performance, and while you were talking, I looked a little bit deeper into his numbers, and I don't think I gave him enough credit when we were first speaking about how good he's been this year. I saw the inflated walk numbers, I saw the inflated homer numbers, which were kind of like last year's, and I think maybe I was a little bit too down on him from a performance standpoint. What you're saying about the injury risk is probably real. I think it wouldn't be a bad idea for the Astros to throw him his first start, DL him. Make him make one more start maybe at the end of the season, the end of September, and then just try to have him ready to go in October. Especially if there's some shoulder fatigue or a shoulder issue there, but
You're trying to start a mutiny, is what you're saying. Can you imagine going to Justin Verlander, like after his first start in your organization, saying, "Hey, man, we want to put you on the DL for a few weeks"? Like, can you imagine how that conversation would play out? Especially because the Astros don't seem, let's say, hip to interpersonal communication.
You make another excellent point.
Yeah, I just cannot imagine. Verlander would be like, "Actually, I didn't accept this trade. Please send me back to Detroit immediately." I
Yeah,
just want to.
that's a
While
good
we're
point.
talking about the Astros and the deadline, I just want to note Francisco Liriano has made 10 appearances for them. That's 8 2/3 innings. He's given up 12 hits, 8 runs, 6 of those earned. He's walked 7 batters, hit 2 others, and has struck out 4 batters. Tyler Clippard, in 7 appearances, has thrown 6 innings, allowed 8 hits, 5 runs, all of them earned, 1 home run, 2 walks, and has struck out 9 batters while uncorking 3 wild pitches. So, yeah, this team really needed to do something to change their deadline narrative because, my goodness, can you get any worse than either of those guys has performed? Whew.
Nope.
Low bar for Verlander.
Yeah, that's true. And just going into real briefly the return that the Tigers are getting, I think these are some quality players. Perez seems like he's the type of player with at least the potential to be a middle to front of the rotation arm. So I think that's a good pickup for them. Cameron is very toolsy, son of Mike Cameron, and has not had the performance in the minors yet to say he's going to be a star or even an average American League outfield regular. But there's potential in both these guys. So these are the types of pieces that the Tigers need to get in these kinds of deals to really look strong going forward, I think.
Yeah, and I just know I thought you were gonna say Rodgers had the tools to be an average American, and I was going to say like, I don't know what that means, Brian. You're gonna have to
I
expand on
don't
that one
either.
because, right, I'm kind of lost at what you're trying to say, but yeah, it seems like a good deal for them on both sides, and it's a fun one at that. A lot of star power moving around. That said, there was also some not so star power moving around, and we should talk about, who else? Jerry Depoto and the Mariners, because, Depoto wasn't going to let the deadline pass without making some kind of move. And he went out there and acquired Mike Leake and some cash considerations from the Cardinals in a kind of surprising move from my perspective. I don't know. Did you find it surprising that the Cardinals not only kind of gave Leake away, but also threw in some money?
I really don't. I think that the Cardinals have almost an irrational amount of faith in the pitching and their player development staff. And with guys like Luke Weaver and some of the other arms that they have on their team, I think the Cardinals think that they can just bring up these guys who are not really highly touted prospects. So they also just called up Flaherty and get similar to performance than to what Mike Leake was going to provide at little to no cost. So I think that this doesn't surprise me in the same way I was surprised that they didn't trade Lance Lynn before the deadline. I really like this deal for the Mariners. I think it's a really good trade for them. For the Cardinals, I think you're introducing a little too much risk into the equation. I mean, this is a team that I would imagine is going to try very hard to compete again next year. They're not rebuilding. So it's kind of I don't know, I think that Leake was priced appropriately for his skill set, and I thought that would have been useful to the Cardinals. So we'll see if they just spend that money elsewhere in signing Justin Upton this offseason or something else like that. But yeah, this was kind of a little bit of a surprising move, I guess, but I do think the Mariners made a good move by acquiring Leake.
Yeah, and I did not mention who the Mariners traded for Leake. That would be a 21-year-old infielder named Raider Escanio. I probably messed that name up. Sorry, Raider. But he's not exactly performed well across three levels this season, including three games at AAA. He's hitting 217, 295, 355. I know he was in the Mariners' top 30 on MLB.com, but I think you definitely give him up. And they basically got Leake for 3 years and $36 million. And I know he struggled leading up to the deadline, but you look at the big picture. He's always been an average or better starting pitcher for the most part. He's boring. He's not someone you're going to tune in to watch, just if you're like a casual fan. But he's pretty consistently been a positive contributor. And yeah, I like that deal a lot for the Mariners. They really needed some starting pitching help, and I think they got him not only on a good deal in terms of prospect cost, but in a good deal in terms of financial cost. And who knows, maybe he's injured and that explains his recent struggles, but it's worth the risk. And good deal, Jerry DePoto.
This is one of those moves that I didn't seem like Jerry DePoto was just churning the roster for the sake of churning the roster. They had a dramatic need. They filled it. Same way the Drew Smyly deal before the season was, man, got to address the rotation with, talent or consistency or some aspect of pitching that they really needed, and they went ahead and did it. Now, Smyly didn't work out. It's possible Leake may not work out, but especially in the short term for the run-up, I mean, he's a huge improvement over, I guess Andrew Albers or whoever else they're going to run out in that rotation. So, nice move, guys. The only big disappointment I have is that Mike Leake won't hit anymore. He's been one of the best hitting pitchers in the National League, and now we'll only get to see him bat in the interleague game. So that's a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah, that is a bummer. Moving on to other bummers. We're without Brody, so that within itself is a bummer. However, I was going to talk about how Cameron Maybin was claimed off waivers from the Angels by the Astros. They take over the rest of his salary. He was making $9 million on the year, so you figure about a month's worth of that is a couple million. And yeah, so Cameron Maybin, what do you think about this move by the Astros?
So I am a bad person to ask about this deal because before the season, when the Angels signed Cameron Maybin, I was like, this is an awesome deal. And I am an irrational Cameron Maybin fan. I think that he's been quietly an average to above average contributor in the outfield. And the fact that the Angels let him go for nothing to clear the salary, I assume, as part of the Justin Upton acquisition is a real big benefit to the Astros, and to have him go to the Astros, who are like, okay, we'll add that salary, and now we have a really high quality fourth outfielder who can get on base. I think that's a huge upgrade for them, actually. I think this is a really cool deal. And now this outfield that they've got, they can withstand an injury really well. They can respond, left to right even better than they could before. I mean, he would make a very good caddy for Derek Fisher offensively, whereas Jake Marisnyk is kind of that caddy defensively. Or he could caddy for Josh Reddick if they want to, go left, right, and in right field as well. So I think this is a really nice move for the Astros.
I would note, though, that Cameron Maybin doesn't have the typical platoon split we associate with right-hand batters. Even this season, he's been better against righties, and for his career, he has a 663 OPS against lefties and a 705 OPS versus righties. So you're not necessarily getting your typical platoon split right-handed hitter here. Otherwise, that makes sense. He is a seemingly a good defender still, seemingly still a good base runner. He has 29 steals on 34 attempts. And yeah, to get him for basically a month's worth of salary from a division rival, albeit one who isn't necessarily fighting you for the same playoff spot, that's a boost. So yeah, it seems like a decent move for the Astros. And I guess I really don't understand it from the Angels' perspective, other than they didn't have the ability to stretch their budget enough for Upton, Phillips, and Maybin. So.
I would have much preferred to see them drop Ben Revere, to be honest, and I think that that might have been a mistake from the Angels' standpoint if they were going to put one of the two out there. And maybe they did put Revere out there, and no, there were no takers, and that could have been the issue there. But I definitely feel like if you had to pick one of the two and you're the Angels, you would probably want to DFA even Revere and stick with Maybin.
I agree with that. And, from one seeming salary dump to another, Juan Nicasio was claimed off waivers by the Phillies. This is confusing because what had happened here is the Pirates had supposedly put him on trade waivers. He was claimed by a team who was not identified, but was probably like the Cubs. They didn't seem to actually want to make a deal, so the Pirates pulled him back and then went and put him on outright waivers. And the reasoning that Neil Huntington gave publicly is they wanted him to be able to go to a contender, preferably one in the American League. However, by doing so, by putting him on outright waivers, the Pirates waived any chance of getting a return. So they essentially dumped Nicasio on, well, it turned out to be the Phillies, and saved $600,000. But Nicasio had been really good this season, and optically, it's not a great look when you're dumping one of your better relievers at this point in the season, just seemingly to save money. Did you have any thoughts on how this played out, Brian?
No, I mean, you broke it down pretty well. It's mystifying on a couple of levels because, there was a nice article written by Dave Cameron at Fangraphs about how Nicasio is basically a good reliever that any team can have for free. So if the case is that the Phillies picked him up, the Phillies probably had either the first or second, if I'm not mistaken, waiver claim on Nicasio. So he never even got the chance to go to another team on these outright waivers that could have actually used him. The Phillies just kind of snapped him up and said, he's ours, nobody else can have him. Which is kind of interesting on another level and kind of confusing because what do the Phillies need Juan Nicasio for the end of the season? I mean, he's a reliever of, some value, but the Phillies are completely out of it. Their bullpen's garbage anyway. It could have been a move to prevent him from going to another team or just to, I don't know, shore up the bullpen a little bit in the end of the season. Maybe they really feel like, oh, he's a guy we want to talk about an extension with and, make some inroads in trying to get him for next year. But it doesn't really seem to me like something that the Phillies got a lot of, value beyond the short-term performance for. And if the
Yeah.
Pirates did want him to go to a contender, this is the worst way to do it. Like you basically were saying, well, we're going to take it out of our hands. So it's a weird deal all around.
Yeah, and I would agree that that's probably the Phillies' mindset is to get a look at someone they were targeting in free agency. Or maybe they were hoping to, spin them off with him a day. But whatever the point, it's a little hard to take the Pirates' reasoning that they want to play the kids more and the, what have you, because they went out and acquired Joaquin Benoit at the deadline, and they went out and got Sean Rodriguez, who has another year on his contract. And I don't know, man. They've done some seemingly weird things to me over the last few weeks to a month. And I'll accept on some level that they were looking out for Nicasio's, potential to play in the postseason, let's call it. But it's a weird move overall. Speaking of another weird move, the Texas Rangers traded for Miguel Gonzalez, and I am a Miguel Gonzalez fan. He's pitched well over the last, I think it's like 2 months, basically since the All-Star break, let's put it that way. That said, the Rangers are not really in the postseason race to the extent that they should probably be making moves like this. At this point, they are 4 games back of a wild card spot. They just lost Adrian Beltre to a hamstring injury, so that dampers their chances of making a real run at this thing even more. And Gonzalez is a free agent at season's end. So, did you like this move? Did you find it a little weird that, it's the Rangers doing this and not the Orioles or even the Angels?
I do find it a little strange. I think that this is probably one of those issues where the return made a huge difference, where the White Sox were probably higher on the third tier prospect that they got back from the Rangers than they were about any other of the possible returns that were out there from other pitchers. Taquan Forbes is a guy who is a name. Like I've heard of him as a prospect before, which may be, maybe there's a scout or people in the player development staff in Chicago who are a little higher on him. But the thing about Gonzalez is he has been good in his last couple of starts, but for the season, he's been very, very bad. And I say that through the lens of DRA, which he's got a 5.56 DRA this season. It's not good. It's about 20% worse than league average. He is a replacement level player by that metric. He was below replacement level in 2014 and 2015 with Baltimore by the same metric. He does not have from an advanced stats perspective, a very good track record, which could be one of the reasons why, the front offices in, let's say, Los Angeles or in Houston, who have analytics-based front offices who are very, very smart and probably look at data similar to DRA, they may not be as excited about adding Miguel Gonzalez because they already have replacement level starters.
At what point, though, do you say, you know what, even though his advanced statistics aren't great, he has consistently been an average or better starter? I mean, this is his sixth season, and in 5 of those seasons, assuming that he can keep up his current level of production, he's finished the year with an ERA plus of 100 or better. Strikeout to walk ratio is a career low 1.81, but in every other season, he finished at least above the 2 mark. I mean, at what point do you say, you know what, there's perhaps something in his game that is not being captured or is not being proper valuely, excuse me, proper valuely, that is not being properly valued by these advanced metrics. And I would just note that, for his career, he has thrown 58% quality starts. He has had a few awful games this season that are sort of, let's say, anchoring his statistics in the wrong direction. But I don't know. I feel like he's perfectly serviceable number 4, number 5, and I would be willing to take a chance on him. I don't know what it is about his game that is not being captured. It's not like a Joe Saunders situation where he's inducing a ton of ground ball double plays, and it's not like a Jeremy Hellickson situation where he's inducing a ton of infield fly balls, but he is above average for his career in both marks, 15% infield flies, whereas the MLB average over that time is 13%. 12% double plays, whereas the MLB average is 11%. So I don't know. I don't know what to make of the discrepancy between his, baseball card statistics, let's say, and his advanced statistics, but I'd be willing to find out, especially at this cost.
Yeah, the cost is the big deal, right? Because it's a very different discussion if you're giving up a real, prospect of value for him, which it does not seem was the case here. It's not a very high value prospect. I will throw this out there too as another point against Gonzalez is that he doesn't tend to throw a lot of innings despite making a lot of starts. He tends to get the hook pretty early, with less than 160 innings over the past 4 years in each of the past 4 years, and it seems to be he'll probably end up getting close to that this year. I just it's could be one of those quality of contact things where he's been able to hold on to it and he'll be continue to be able to hold on to it, but strikeout rate's not good, and the quality of contact may be a thing, but I just I tend to trust more in the advanced metrics than I do in the ERA and the runs against. From runs against perspective, it's not like it's a dramatic difference between his ERA and his RA9. He's not getting a substantial difference in earned runs versus unearned runs, so it could be just what you say. It could be that he just controls his contact better than the average guy.
Yeah, and I would note though, I know you mentioned the innings, that's a fair point, but he is averaging over 6 innings this season, and he's consistently been in that 5.5 to 6 inning range. For number four, number five, I mean, again, at this cost, that's not too bad. You're not going to want Miguel Gonzalez pitching, a third or fourth time against most orders. So I think, if you're realistic about what he is, and I think we both are, this is a perfectly fine addition, even if the Rangers are 4 games out. Of course, we say that, but, the Mariners are actually farther away from a wild card spot than the Rangers are, and we weren't sitting here talking about how the Mike Leake trade was a waste. Granted, Leake has a couple more years of control remaining, but they're similar styles in that they're both, unimposing righties who aren't going to blow you away with raw stuff, and they're not necessarily going to pitch to Cy Young level qualities, but both can help a team. And the Rangers were throwing out some real losers in that back of that rotation, so
Yeah,
it's a
that's
likable
I
deal,
hear.
even if it's a little weird. And on that note, we're moving to a former Ranger and now a former Mariner because Seattle shipped Leonis Martin to the Chicago Cubs yesterday in a deal that flew underneath the radar for obvious reasons. I am a big Leonis Martin fan. I'm a little surprised it's the Cubs acquiring him, however.
Yeah, that's kind of a weird fit, I feel like. The Cubs seemed okay stacked in the outfield, and with Albert Almora Jr. in place, and John Jay, and Ian Happ, and Jason Hayward, and Kyle Schwarber, and Ben Zobrist, and Fritz Bryant, that's a lot of outfielders. I don't know if Martin's a guy who's actually going to be with the major league team in October. Yeah, it kind of is a mystifying move from that perspective. I don't know what he brings that's so much different than what Albert Almora might bring to this team.
Yeah, I don't know either. I would say the fact that they went out here and got him at this point suggests they intend for him to be with a team come postseason time. And maybe it's just a matter of viewing him from a different lens. Maybe they see him as a good pinch runner type or something, but he hasn't even been that good at stealing bases. So
No.
he is a good clubhouse presence, or supposedly is. I know he had a falling out with the Rangers. He has not hit at all this season in the majors. He's not yet 30. I don't believe if he did, he just turned 30. Nope, he's not yet 30. Won't be 30 till next March. So he's still on the fairly young side. And, he does everything except hit for the most part. So, and he has hit in the minors to his credit, PCL or not, 306, 346, 492. He's been a useful, even an above average big league player in the past. And it doesn't really seem like they're going to give much up here. So I guess I like it on those grounds. I'm just confused about the fit for the reasons you mentioned. And I'm not quite sure what they're thinking other than, hey, let's get a guy with a good track record, or a decent track record, I should say, and let's add some depth in case we suffer an injury. Because, I guess if Almora were to go down, or if Jay were to go down, or even if Jason Hayward were to go down, it would behoove the Cubs to have one more layer of depth, at least up the middle. So yeah, I guess that's maybe what they're thinking here is, let's go out and add a talented player if we can for nothing, and just in case there's an injury, he's better than what they could perhaps produce on the, September waiver wire, and he's also going to be eligible for the postseason. So those are added benefits. Beyond that, I really don't know if there's, some master plan here, or if it's just a matter of the Cubs being opportunistic. And, I'm a fan of opportunistic additions, so.
The one thing that I'll point out is that Albert Almora's defense, statistically, Almora, his defense is kind of his calling card, and I'm not sure the quote advanced defensive metrics are backing up that reputation for defense that he has the same way that those advanced defensive metrics adore Leonis Martin. So having them both be right-handed hitting center fielders who can move
Well,
around a little bit and be good defensively, I think maybe, I don't know, maybe the Cubs are trying to look at it from the perspective of maybe it's time for them to move on from Almora and
Martin is
Martin's.
lefty, though. I would know. Martin is lefty.
Oh, I thought he was a right-handed hitter. That was my mistake, but
Gosh, Brian.
I am just doing such a bad job today.
It
But
would be funny, though, if Martin ends up replacing Jason Hayward. That would be amazing on so many different levels. I don't think it's likely, but that would be kind of
yeah,
funny.
I would say it's much more likely that he'll end up replacing John Jay, but
Another one of my favorites. Hey, John Jay has performed pretty solidly this season. Let's be honest. 291, 381, 381. Not a lot of power, but you're never going to expect a lot of power of John Jay. Yeah, he's not really a center field level defender, but, given what he actually is making and given the expectations for him, I think he's been, perfectly fine.
and his on-base percentage is awesome. He
Yeah.
is a good hitter.
Not a
But
good
yeah,
fielder, but yeah.
he's a lefty. And so, and Jay had went 4 for 5 in his last game. So it's like, obviously they're not going to cut bait on him. It's a weird move. Rich get richer, and the
Yep.
Mariners get rid of a guy who didn't seem to be in their plans. I mean, the way he was DFA'd multiple times this season, so.
Maybe they're doing him a favor, though, by shipping him to the Cubs. Maybe that's the aspect we're ignoring here. Like, maybe DePoto just called every contender in the National League and was like, hey, we love this guy as an individual. Doesn't really fit into our plans anymore. Would you have a use for him? And we'd like to get him there just in case he could perhaps make your postseason roster due to injury or what have you.
Oh man,
So.
if that's the case, the Diamondbacks missed out, man. They should have been
Yeah.
the one who would who I think he'd be a great fit for, but or maybe even or same thing might even be true for the Nationals, but hey, who
Speaking of
knows?
missing out, I think that's about all we have for this episode. I am RJ Anderson, and Brian, tell the people where they can find you.
They can find me at Baseball Prospectus, the same place they've always been able to find me.
And they can find me at CBS Sports. Till next time, perhaps we will claim our own producer, Sean Brody, back off waivers from Desus and Mero. If not, you'll be hearing these voices in the same spot next week. So thank you for listening and have a good weekend.